Now live from Everbank Field, 1010 XL 92.5 FM presents Jaguars Today with your host Mike Dempsey and Jeff Lagerman.
Hey, welcome in everybody. Glad you're along with us here. Jaguars Today for the next 2 hours, brought to you by Kenny Lay and Associates, DivorceMenOnly.com. Every Tuesday, Mike Dempsey, Jeff Lagerman, Fat Tony here with you on 1010 XL 92.5 FM. Jeff, let's dive right into this, because the thing about Brett Favre, and you make that comparison, and that's I can see where you're coming from with that. He had a lot of success. He did put up a lot of numbers. He did turn the ball over at inopportune times, but he was able to generally overcome that over the course of his career. Now, maybe early on that he suffered some losses because of that. But the bottom line is this team really hurt itself with turnovers this weekend. We know that. How do you walk that line between wanting Blake Bortles to be aggressive, to take the, to make the kind of throw he made to Brian Walters for that touchdown to close the gap, and to also realize when it's, you know, you live to fight another down? How do you find that middle ground?
I think sometimes you have to actually experience it before you can understand it, and that's kind of what Brett Favre had to go through, and that's what, you know, Blake Bortles is going through, you know, and sometimes that's a hard lesson to be learned. You know, you can sit there and have the greatest coach in the world, and sometimes you got a player that just has to see it to believe it, and that's okay. You know, that's okay, especially if he's not going to make the same mistakes again and again and again. Like the sack caused fumble, that was something new. I mean, typically Blake is scrambling up into the pocket and then he takes off and runs. This is the first time that he scrambled up into the pocket and then kind of paralleled the line of scrimmage. So this is kind of his first experience with that. The first interception that he threw against in the early part of that game, that was just a great play by Darrell Revis. The one that was last, you understand that he wants to push it, but at the same time, it's first down, you know?
I mean, I'm with you.
I mean, come on. You know, you got to be smarter than that. You're rolling to your right, and you're not throwing completely across your body, but you're still throwing somewhat across your body.
You're not planted. You don't have everything behind the throw.
Not a good throw to make. And if he threw a 90-mile-an-hour fastball, he probably could have squeezed that in there, but you can't throw a 90-mile-an-hour fastball on the run across the body.
Right. With that, then, what is going on when you hear Gus Bradley, and we'll hear from him later on, talk about, you know, we're doing good things in all phases of the game, but at key moments, we seem to not be making the plays, whether it's defense is playing well, but we can't get them off the field on a critical third down, or the offense is driving, and you get that key penalty at the wrong time that kills momentum. Special teams gives up a big return, or in the case of a muff punt, a game-changing type play like you had there. Is there something collectively going on? Is it a case of so many young guys on this roster? I'm not trying to make an excuse. I'm asking you from your history and playing experience, what do you point to when it's you're having critical breakdowns at the worst moments from all phases of your team?
And I think it's critical breakdowns or breakdowns that aren't just at critical moments. I mean, you go to the first half of that ball game, and you know, during the course of the game, I make a lot of notes. You had a 53-yard kick return by Cromartie that you were outflanked, and there was absolutely no reason to be outflanked. The muff. Yeah, it was a critical moment, but was it any different than allowing a 53-yard kick return in the first half? No. You know, in the first half on the drive, Telvin Smith jumps offside on what was like, I think, a 3rd and 8 or a 3rd and 7,
yeah,
which gave them the ability to convert the first down.
Right.
That's a critical mistake, even though it's not at a critical juncture or viewed as being at a critical juncture in the ball game. It allowed the drive to stay alive because they converted on 4th down because they went for it because they had a kicker issue. So you can point to that. You can point to the 3rd and 12 screen in the first half defensively that you allowed, that little middle screen. I mean, things like that all add up. They don't have to be critical to be in the fourth quarter when you're trying to come back and you're in a one-possession game that you can win. I mean, there's a lot of different things throughout the course of the game that need to be cleaned up. And the importance, obviously, it's getting emphasized in practice because I know that they have, you know, the bonus Mondays and all those kind of things. They have extra periods throughout the course of practice to address certain things. But I think the awareness, and I think that was the hardest thing for me to learn when I came into the league, is that every play matters so much, and it can become critical, even though it doesn't appear to be critical at the moment, but it can be critical at the end result when you look back at it.
So what is it then? Is it a lack of focus? I mean, if you're saying these guys are being coached and they're, you know, obviously the coaching staff says, here's the mistake you're making, don't make this mistake, here's the way you want to do it, right? I mean, we're naive to think that they're not trying to show them the proper way to do these things, are they not getting the message across in the proper way, or is it not being received properly, or are these guys just, you know, losing their mind, their focus momentarily?
I think it's a little bit everything. I think it needs to be coached better. It needs to be heard better. It needs to be executed better. And if those things don't happen, then you get players that can execute it better. Then you get players that can teach it better. I mean, it's quite simple. I mean, that's kind of how it's got to work, and that's the way it is in the National Football League. So I think eventually the inexperience becomes a past thing. It's still in the conversation now because this team, for the most part, is 22, 23, 24-year-olds, you know, for the most part. But I think when you get to the point where you're at now, in year three, second half of the season, that stuff needs to start to fade away. And I think that that's my expectation here in the second half of the season, that it needs to start to fade away.
How do you look at the game that Blake Bortles played? Because on the one hand, you say, man, without 380 yards passing and a couple of touchdowns and some great escapes out of a really hectic, crazy pocket where he scrambled for some yards or at least was able to get rid of the football, you're not in position to come back and win that game, but at the same time, you know, a couple of key turnovers give the Jets opportunities to score points. So, you know, he giveth, he taketh away.
Right.
In the overall sum of things, how do you think he played?
Well, I think twofold. I think you kind of have two opinions on it. One is that you get discouraged because the mistakes happened. But at the same token, how many quarterbacks, young quarterbacks, can give you what he's giving you right now? And that's the ability to come back, like what he did against the Buffalo Bills in London, what he did against the New York Jets, where he gave you a chance. I mean, heck, at the end of the half, two plays, 50 yards, bam, you're in the end zone. You know, how many young quarterbacks do you even have the confidence to use the timeouts at the end of the half where Todd Bowles is sitting there trying to grind the clock out when your opponent has timeouts left? A lot of coaches and coaching staffs would have been content to just go ahead and let the clock run out at the end of the half, which is insane if you'd allow that to happen. But you have to have confidence in a quarterback and an offense at that juncture to be able to say, no, we're going to go ahead, even if we have 20 seconds left, we're going to take an opportunity here.
Did you, you know, because we debated that when it happened. I thought I would have called the timeout right after first down. I wouldn't have played. I don't go into the mindset of Jets ran the ball on first down. Now we're going to call timeout. Now they're going to decide that we're going to try to get aggressive. Let them, because they haven't driven the ball on you all game.
Yeah, and it's easy to say, well, you should have used it after the first down because maybe the mindset is not known at that time. You don't know that Todd Bowles is just trying to grind the clock out.
But even if he's not, I mean, at that point, are you feeling confident that your defense has done a pretty good job with, you know, they had one short field drive in the first half that, hey, let's stop these guys. Let's dictate to them.
No, I like the idea of using it after. You know, I liked the way they used it. I thought was perfect because after second down they used
right.
it, and then they used it after third down, and then they saved one for their offense. I like that idea, and it for two reasons. One, it allows your offense to have a timeout to still be able to work the middle of the field at some point when you do get the ball. Number two is that if you use the timeout after first down, then all of a sudden their idea was just to be conservative on the first play and then to open it up. They still have their own timeouts and plenty of time left to be able to execute their own drive. So it was nice to see that they waited to use it. And then you saw that they were trying to grind the clock out. But after first down, you don't know for sure.
I still would have used it after first down because in the end, I get to having the timeout thing. I'd give me the 30 to 35 seconds instead of the timeout because I can run a couple of plays where I can get out of bounds. I think I'm going to be able to do more.
I mean,
it worked out.
Yeah, goes either way. It goes either way. But I think when you're on offense and you can at least just have one timeout to be able to stop the clock and work the middle of the field, I think is very important because for me, if you don't have that timeout, I think it limits your play calling to some extent because you're worried about clock management so much instead of just taking chunk yardage.
All right, let's take a quick timeout here, and we'll open things up to the Jaguar fan base out there at 641-1010, both on the phone lines, and also that's the Boston's Restaurant and Sports Bar text line number. Today, your fan feedback question of the day asks you, which Jaguars performance do you think benefited the most from having a week off during the bye? Who was able to take that opportunity to maybe get a little bit healthier, get a little bit more life back in their legs, and give you a performance that maybe you wouldn't have expected prior to having that week of rest? You can weigh in on that at MD underscore 1010XL, at Logs 56, L-O-G-S 56, and at 1010XL Fat Tony on Twitter. Jaguars Today Facebook page open for business as well. And if you want to talk about the other side of the coin, which guy's performance surprised you going in the other direction, that you thought with a week off might have been better than it was, we could talk about that. We'll get into who played well, who didn't, which units excelled, which ones were left wanting for the Jacksonville Jaguars against the New York Jets, and we'll spend some time looking ahead to the Baltimore Ravens a little bit later on in the show as well. With Jeff Lagerman and Fat Tony, I'm Mike Dempsey. Tuesdays brought to you by Kenny Lane Associates, DivorceMenOnly.com. It's Jaguars Today on 1010XL 92.5 FM.
Now more with Jeff Lagerman, brought to you by Roland Reich Plumbing on Jaguars Today, 1010XL, 92.5 FM.
All right, back here with you on this Tuesday, live at Everbank. Mike Dempsey, Jeff Lagerman, Fat Tony here with you, as Tuesday's brought to you by Kenny Lane Associates, DivorceMenOnly.com. If you want to get in with Logs today, pick his brain on what he saw on the film, 641-1010 is the phone number. That's also the Boston's Restaurant and Sports Bar text line. We will check in there coming up shortly. We'll hear from Gus Bradley coming up as well. And on we go. Loggy, let's get to a little O-line talk. Okay. Right now for the Jacksonville Jaguars. Okay. They, with the exception of one long run by TJ Yeldon, they didn't do much in the run game. I understand the Jets rankings in the, you know, various defensive categories. And for a Jets team that only came in with 11 sacks, Blake Bortles got sacked six times in this game. I know you had talked about watching them on film. They got a lot more pressure than the sack total would indicate. But as you evaluate the line, first as a whole, and then maybe we'll go through individually, what did you come away thinking after watching the film?
Let me start with this, the inability to run the football. The nose tackle for the Jets might be probably the most underrated nose tackle in football, Damon Harrison. Really good football player. Went to some small school by the name of William Penn. I don't even know. Do they play football at William Penn?
I'm guessing they do.
He's in the NFL, so I'm guessing
right.
They
I'm
do.
Thinking they must play some level of football.
Is it like
William
club football?
Penn.
I don't know, but he's a hell of a player now. I mean, he Wisniewski had a tough time with him. Everybody had a tough time with him. As far as protection goes, I thought the offensive line did okay. The biggest issue was, I thought, T.J. Yeldon, which is surprising. I mean, T.J., I mean, that was probably the most surprising thing with TJ all year long, was his ability to block and blitz pickup, which was something that they really weren't very high on when he came out of Alabama. And the Jets, when you are playing against them and they get you in third and seven plus, they start taking out a few of those big defensive linemen that they have, and then all of a sudden they start walking up all the linebackers that they can put in. And the two blitzes that they really got pressure on, it was 56, and I'm going to refer to my sheet, DeMario Davis, is walked up in the line of scrimmage with 52 David Harris. And then DeMario Davis will actually retreat with one step, turn his head to look at coverage. And a lot of times as a running back, your first thought is he was just showing. And then you start looking to the next responsibility that you have, but the Jets had shown on film, and I think TJ didn't have quite enough patience of it, that DeMario Davis, when he does that, he'll take a step back, turn his head and look in coverage, and then turn back right around and find an opening, and he's coming. And so that confused him on two different instances. I think one time it ended up getting TJ, the other time it was an offensive lineman. And then TJ struggled on the edge when he was blocking the blitz and safety. Deion Bailey, one instance, and then he got swam on another instance. I can't remember if that was Deion Bailey or a linebacker. But the offensive line could have been stouter. But you know what? They're pretty good now. Muhammad Wilkerson, Sheldon Richardson, and Sheldon Richardson played way better than he did last week or the week before against the Oakland Raiders. And you remember Muhammad Wilkerson called the Jets out for being
loafing? Yeah.
I think he was referring to Sheldon Richardson. Because if you actually watch the film, Sheldon Richardson was chasing plays 40 yards down the field. I think Muhammad was calling out his teammate in a nice, subtle way.
Maybe, and they're both chasing the same contract, so I wouldn't put it past him to subtly insinuate that I'm the one who deserves it.
Well,
more than the other guy.
I'm Mike McCagnan, is that right?
McCagnan, yeah.
McCagnan, the general manager of the Jets, I'm going to give it to Muhammad Wilkerson.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, Sheldon Richardson, is you're kind of nervous about him because
right.
of the issues that he's had off the field.
Prior to that, I mean, though, has been considered probably the better player prior to this year.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, last year he was the team MVP.
Right.
But Wilkerson right now, you watch the way he plays, he's just sneaky strong pass rusher, kind of like Clyde Simmons in a lot of ways was for many years with the Philadelphia Eagles. But I would pay that money to Wilkerson.
And they got Leonard Williams coming up.
Yeah, and he's still trying to figure it out, you know. But he gets great push, you know. And I was before the game walking around MetLife Stadium in a couple different places. They had the Jets pregame radio broadcast piped in,
mm-hmm.
kind of like what they do with our pregame broadcasts and tailgate show that you and JP host. And happened to catch, and I don't know who the analyst was for the Jets at the time, but he was talking about when is Leonard Williams going to show up. And I'm sitting there going, what the hell film are you watching? You know, Leonard Williams is a good football player, great with his hands, great against the run, great push in the pocket. Is he a dominant pass rusher? No, he's not.
And is that what it is? It just comes down to numbers with I think so
because unfortunately, a lot of guys that are in the role like me and Tony just don't take the time to watch the film to kind of understand it. They're just looking at the stat sheet. I mean, spend some time and watch some film, man. Leonard Williams is a good football player.
That's why Logs is in here every Tuesday.
Well, it's also why you can understand sometimes that players just get mad. You know, when media wants to talk to, they know the guys that do and don't know what's going on, generally speaking. And a guy that's calling Leonard Williams out, when are you going to show up? If I'm Leonard Williams, I'm like, I'm not talking
right.
to that
you
guy.
Right, you don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, when the Jets got that package on the field where they had Davis, Harris, the guy that's been really impressive, Lorenzo Maldon, the third-round pick out of Louisville, 55.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and Calvin Pace, and all of a sudden they start getting all those linebackers on the field. It's a little bit like Rex Ryan in that, you know, you don't know who's coming, who's dropping, and that's a tough situation to be in, and you got to avoid third and long, but the Jets are so good that, you know, going in that game, number two in the National Football League at yards per rush allowed, you know, second to only the Jaguars,
right.
which the Jaguars are still going to be at number one, obviously, after that performance. But that's tough sledding.
All right, let's get to a couple phone calls here with Jeff Loggeman, Mike Dempsey, Fat Tony here with you, Jaguars, today on this Tuesday. Morgan on the west side going to lead us off today. Hi, Morgan. How are you?
Hey, guys. How y'all doing this morning?
Good. What's up?
I just, you know, as you guys look around the league, do y'all see a team that has a bigger upside than the Jaguars do when you take into consideration the key components that the Jaguars don't have available to them right now? I mean, you know, over the past few weeks, to me, the Jaguars are a tremendously improved football team. Given the youth on the team, this is a good time to be a Jaguar fan to me. I think in a couple of years, this team is going to be one of the better teams in the league. I think it's right there at their fingertips. If they can just grasp hold of it, then there's going to be some big things for the Jaguars in the future. And another thing is I hope the coaching staff doesn't lose faith in Nick Marshall. To me, that guy is a tremendous football player. I mean, when you can make the switch like he's made and get on the field, to put yourself in those situations where you do make a mistake, but I think this guy is going to pay off in the end for the Jaguars.
Yeah, good call. I mean, it's, you know, the question is there another team in the league that you would be as excited about as you are with the Jaguars being so youthful?
I know the right answer.
Yeah, I mean, there's other teams.
It's Carolina. Carolina's the youngest team in the league.
Yeah, Carolina's young.
You know, Oakland looks pretty good.
I think when you look at that, the first thing that you have to do is evaluate the quarterback situation with the team.
Right.
You know, okay, the Raiders probably feeling pretty good about Derek Carr.
Yeah.
Cam Newton's still a very young player and a very young roster mm-hmm. overall. Aaron Rodgers, but I mean, everybody knows they're good. I mean, it's not like that's an up-and-coming team.
People are excited about Minnesota with Teddy Bridgewater.
Yeah, Teddy Bridgewater's been pretty good.
I don't think he's been okay. But they're 6-2. You can't argue with the results, right?
Absolutely
now,
so. Not. You know, Mike Zimmer's doing a great job. Didn't do a great job this past weekend and how he reacted, but, you know, I mean, there are pieces to be excited about. You know, but there's also still some issues that need to be addressed with this football team. You know, I mean, there's still some holes. And, you know, you talk to Gus and Dave, and they know it, and although they're not going to speak of it. But, I mean, I think quietly they know it. I mean, you'd love to have your pass-rushing first-round draft pick. you know, you'd like to go ahead next year and dabble in the free agency once again and find another outside edge rusher. You'd like to find maybe an impactful linebacker that where Dan Skuda can go to more of a reserve role and as a primary special teams player, and somebody can put their hand on the ground and rush the passer. And I mean, there's definitely holes that need to be filled that you can't address in a couple years when you just completely dismantle the roster. But yeah, I mean, there's reason to be excited. But at the end of the rainbow, you know, I get the fans that also at the same token are sitting there going, wait a minute, what's to be excited about? We're 2-6. I mean, you need to start seeing some wins show up in the win column. And that's part of the encouragement and part of the measuring stick for all NFL teams and NFL coaches.
We'll get back to Nick Marshall. We'll address him coming up later, but I want to get one more in before the break here. And that's David on the west side checking in here on Jaguars today. Good morning, David.
Hey, good morning, guys. Y'all do a great job together. Y'all should get another time where Lachman comes in with you, Mike. Y'all really do a good job. Just want to say I was living on the west side. I actually had moved to Jersey last year and had a really cool fan experience this weekend. I was at the game. It was my son's first NFL game, a three-year-old boy, and he had a ball. We got $157 tickets for $22 and sat right on the 10-yard line with the Jaguars coming into the end zone there at the end. Everybody in New York with the kid there, I was cheering and, you know, doing a lot of things, and they didn't say one bad thing, no cussing or anything like that, so they were great. Just wanted to make a couple of comments about some things that I saw and take it off the air with you guys. The first thing is, you know, wonderful play from some of the young guys, Blake, and the receivers looks, you know, so good sometimes, but I called in the other day on the Gus Bradley show, and I told him that we support him and Dave with a lot of the people that have been season ticket holders from the beginning, and I made the comment that Gene Smith, nothing personal, but he probably couldn't have done a worse job if he was trying to sabotage the team as a GM. And I told Gus, I said, a fan can expect too much too fast with the way that roster was, but where he's losing me is on a play like the onside kick. I don't think there's any scenario with a timeout and the 2-minute warning left and your defense is playing really well where you kick that onside. And as it turned out, you get the ball at like the 40 instead of getting the ball down there deep where Blake threw the interception. And the other comment that I wanted to make was is that Luke Jokel falls right on the ball. I'm trying to ride it out with Luke Jokel. Everybody wants him to be good. He doesn't get the ball. Nick Marshall doesn't get the fumble. You know, just plays like that where you get back on the ball and we win that game because they couldn't stop Blake at all at the end of that game. We had a wonderful time, but I'm just not mad anymore. I'm kind of sad because I really wanted to win that game. And the Jets fans, it was like a morgue. I mean, they were so quiet. They thought they had lost the game when it was 1st and 10 at the 10. So I appreciate you guys.
Yeah, I'm not mad at Nick Marshall. I mean, the ball didn't bounce the way, you know, for him to be able to recover it because he's running before he caught it. You know, I mean, am I mad at him? No, I'm disappointed that he didn't make the catch first, but I know what he was thinking. He's thinking, oh, yeah, look at all this green that I have in front of me, and I'm going to make a big play. I'm going to be a hero. I've got to make the catch first. Luke Jokel diving for the ball, and he's like the only Jaguar, and there's like four Jets guys. You know, that happens.
Look, dude, that's the tough thing to be critical of. I wanted Puzlesny to fall right on that
ball,
too.
Paul's had he had
but,
it.
But he's in position, and he's trying to make a play, and that's not a play. I mean, the ball is bouncing funny ways. Bodies are flying around in there.
That happens.
You know, that to me is, they gave the effort to, at least in the case of Jokel and Puzlesny. I never thought that Marshall had a chance to recover his own.
No, he
did. The guy was on it almost
immediately. He was already two steps ahead, and the ball was staying where he was at. You know, that's how much he was taking off already without making the catch.
One thing I just wanted to bring up quickly about Nick Marshall, because I've been hearing this a lot in the last couple of days. Just, you know, what can you expect? He's a guy. He was a college quarterback last year. You can't expect him to be this or that immediately. And I started thinking, have we seen this happen with other college quarterbacks? And I went back and didn't take too far to go back to Antoine Randle-El. Mm-hmm. Antoine Randle-El was nothing but a quarterback at Indiana, and he came in and they made him a slot receiver and a punt returner and a kick returner, and he never had these issues. So it's not, to me, I don't think you get a pass because you were playing quarterback.
No.
That's your job to be the punt returner. Now, I'm not trying to kill the guy, but to me, that doesn't hold water that, hey, he was playing quarterback at Auburn last year. The guy's been playing football his whole life.
Yeah, he knows how to play football.
He knows how to catch a football.
Yeah, the one thing I will say, it's not issues. I mean, he had one issue so far. You know,
well, yeah,
so,
you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a big moment, though.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, And, you know, you can sit there and debate, you know, should the reliable Brian Walters be back there instead of Nick Marshall? But here's the thing, I think as a coaching staff, you know, you trust your eyes and you know that Nick Marshall has more electricity to him as a returner, critical point in the game. You know, you'd like to get some field position, maybe a big return. You know, Brian Walters hasn't really shown that to you yet. He hasn't shown you that once he's caught the ball. He catches the ball great, and he's so dependable, running routes, catching the ball, making the tough catches. But, I mean, a returner is really not his thing. You know, I'll be glad when Rashad Green gets back. You know, a guy that's been doing it for longer, you have a little bit more stuff or history that you can trust with a Rashad Green. So it's going to be interesting also in the next couple of weeks, you know, staying on this Rashad Green thing, is that if Marquise Lee becomes available, you know, what are you going to do? I mean, you got Rashad Green, who's a viable returner.
You got Walters playing well.
Brian Walters being a guy that Blake Bortles trusts. Do you risk taking that off the field?
Right, but he does add an element, right? I mean, just the open field and the quick twitch running ability and the speed and all that, that
no doubt
they could certainly use.
That's a hard decision.
I understand that, but that, I think that's why they're keeping their options open. Yeah. And right now it's not an issue.
Because, yeah, you don't have to make a decision yet.
Well, and they have plenty of guys that right now it's a question of which healthy guys are inactive on game day, which is a much better place to be in.
Nice to be. It's first time.
Right, when you got four or five or six spots already taken up when you go into Sunday and you know the decision's made
for
you.
Which was the case, what, for the first five, six weeks of the season? You were struggling to find guys to dress and even have guys dress that didn't play for the first 6 weeks of the season.
All right, if you'd like to get in today, 641-1010, the phone number, that's also the Boston's Restaurant and Sports Bar text line number. Question of the day today asks you, which player benefited the most from a week of rest? Whose performance do you think was amped up due to a little bit of fresh leg syndrome, if you will? Mike Dempsey, Jeff Lagerman, Fat Tony here with you. Tuesdays brought to you by the law offices of Kenny Lay & Associates, DivorceMenOnly.com. We'll get more of your calls coming up. Also hear a little bit from Gus Bradley as he spoke yesterday with a day to reflect on the Jaguars' Week 9 performance against the New York Jets. We're live at Everbank on 1010XL, 92.5 FM.
Now more with Jeff Lagerman, brought to you by Roland Reich Plumbing on Jaguars Today, 1010XL, 92.5 FM.
All right, we got a little bit from the head coach coming up here momentarily. Let's get a couple more quick calls in with Jeff Lagerman. It's Jaguars Today on a Tuesday, brought to you by Kenny Lay & Associates, DivorceMenOnly.com. Time to go to the classroom once again with Professor Loggs. Let's get Kevin in here next up on Jags Today. What's up, Kevin? How are you?
Hey, Jeff. How you doing this morning, man?
Doing good.
Well, just looking at it like this, man, just want to bring a point. Seems like to me, you know, Blake is relying a little bit on his legs a little bit too much. I don't actually want to say too much. I'll say in maybe in the instinctive situation where, okay, I really don't have time to think this out. I got to make a play. I got to do something. You know, he kind of reversed to those legs, and I think the defenses have gotten to the point where, okay, this guy's going to roll. He's going to try to get out. He's going to use those legs. So stay alert because he's going to lock in on somebody. And that's kind of who he tends to go with as opposed to make a decision. I'm going to use my legs, get out of bounds, or I'm going to let this ball go. I think that's kind of playing into the defense a lot in a lot of the things we see.
Well, I don't necessarily agree with you. I understand that, you know, as a young player, I'm okay with them kind of having a crutch, so to speak, early in their career. I mean, John Elway was very similar to Blake in a lot of ways in that he would rely on his legs early on. But at the same token, Blake still does have the ability to stay in the pocket. Now, is it a drawback that he extends plays? Absolutely not. The one completion that he had to Allen Robinson on the Jet sideline that was over there against Darrell Revis, I mean, that was a direct result of Blake extending the play and then making a great throw on the run. That's the one unique thing, I think, about Blake as compared to other quarterbacks. Like, you watch, you know, not to refer too much back to Blaine Gabbert, when Blaine Gabbert would get on the run, his eyes would drop and he never could make accurate throws on the run. Blake might be one of the most accurate passers, you know, obviously as good as Aaron Rodgers, because Aaron Rodgers might be the best, but he's extremely accurate on the run, which is a unique trait to have. And like the interception that he had at the end of the game, you know, it was a bad decision. It was an accurately thrown ball, but he just thought that the window was a little bit bigger than that. I mean, he actually put it on the money where he wanted it to go, but he just thought he had more time to squeeze it in there. So, you know, I'm okay with where he's at in his development. I think that what we're seeing out of him is fantastic. way ahead of the curve compared to a lot of the quarterbacks that have played this game in history, if you look at it from a statistical standpoint. And I think, and most importantly, when you evaluate it from just the eye test, which is the ability to give a football team hope at the end of the game or at the end of the half, he has a special ability to rise his level of play. And that's the one thing I think I talked about last year. He has that ability. And when you have a quarterback that has that ability, it gives you hope.
Thank you for the call there as we move along to Ron in Gainesville next up. Thank you, Kevin. Hi, Ron. How are you?
I'm pretty good. How about you guys?
Good. What's up?
All right. I want to preface my question with saying that I think Shad's a great owner. I think Mark Lamping is a great president, and I really like our management all the way down to blind to the coach. I'm personally on the mindset that this team needs more talent. So I personally wouldn't like to see us make the playoffs this year opposed to us making the playoffs the next 3 years in a row. Because I think with more talent on this team and better draft picks, we can do that. I wanted to know if you guys are GM for the day, would 5-11 or 6-10 be enough for Dave to go into Shad's office and say, we need to keep Gus Bradley here as a coach?
All right. I think, well, first of all, if they went 6-10, that means they go 4-4 in their last eight.
Which is pretty good.
At this point. You know, so from that standpoint, if you ask at the beginning of the season, I think I picked 6-10 for this team. Might have been 7-9. It was right around.
Yeah, I was right at 7.
6 or 7.
7 being on the high side.
Yeah, 6 or 7, whatever it was. So 6-10 would fall in line with kind of my expectations for this year. So if they were able to win 4 of their last 8, and then you look at, you know, were they blown out? You know, there's definitely been improvement. I get the record hasn't improved, right? But I can see improvement. And I can recognize that. So for me, you know, if they're not suffering any more losses like they did to the Patriots, and the Patriots are the Patriots, that was the one game you're never really in this year, and they were able to win 4 of their last 8 games, I don't think there's any question that Gus Bradley would be back.
No, I don't think there's any doubt, you know.
What would it take? Would he, if he doesn't win another game, can he survive?
That's the problem.
Right. There's a number, right? And what?
There's always a number, but I mean, we don't know what that number is,
right?
But there is, you know, obviously there is a number.
Obviously, you think 2-14 would be too much of a.
Would not be good.
Would not be good for Gus's job security, right?
No.
So then you got to.
Wouldn't be good for anybody's job security.
Understood, but somewhere between 2 and let's say 6, where we'd feel like he's a lock to come back, that's kind of the gray area, right, of what he needs to get done.
Yeah, and
ultimately,
who knows what it is?
I mean, is this a Dave Caldwell? I guess it is. I mean, Shad Khan hired him to be his football man and to make these kind of decisions, but how much influence, obviously he has all the influence he chooses to have, but how much will Shad Khan be involved in these kind of discussions at the end of the season? Or state of the franchise, here's where we stand. Moving forward, here's what I'd like to do. Does Shad Khan need to give the seal of approval? Is Dave autonomous in that? How do you see that?
Well, I don't think I think you always need the owner's approval. And will he be involved in that? Absolutely, as he should be. I mean, he's the owner of the football team. You know, so I don't know when or if or how that conversation would happen, but I guarantee it's going to happen. You know, and I think it would happen whether they finish the season up at 7-9. Shad is a very involved owner. Not on a day-to-day basis, but he, trust me, he's very involved.
What is your opinion of Dave Caldwell's point of view as to the job that Gus Bradley is doing? You know what I'm saying? I mean, Dave is providing him the players. They together kind of joined at the hip in a shared vision of how they wanted this rebuild to play out and how they wanted to build, or however you want to, whatever phrase you want to use. People get offended by the term rebuild sometimes, whatever. So from that standpoint, I mean, I'm sure he's living and dying every week with this as well. How do you think Dave Caldwell looks at the job that Gus Bradley's doing? What's your guess?
Well, first and foremost, a couple weeks ago for the Gus Bradley show in the second block that we do, sat down with Gus and Dave together and talked with them about that relationship. And at that point, you know, it was right after London. You know, you got to win. But, you know, I mean, there's still, you know, things were kind of loud. and talked to them about it, and they basically said that, look, you know, we are in lockstep. You know, we are in full agreement with each other. We have conversations on a daily basis, and I think that it's the relationship that they have is incredibly strong. And I think that Dave has confidence in Gus, and that Dave realized what this job was going to be from the very onset. I don't think that Dave walked in here and told Shad Khan that, look, in 3 years we're going to be a competitor for the playoffs. I think that he had the realistic vision that, look, it's going to take time. It's probably going to take, you know, 4 years, 5 years to build this thing as a perennial winner. And so I think they're on the same page. You know, when you see them interact in the hallways, when you see them interact on game day, post game, I mean, as far as the fan base goes and as far as I'm concerned, I'm incredibly joyful of what I see, because I've seen the other end of that spectrum to where you have a general manager and a coach that aren't on the same page, that aren't functioning together. Perfect example is Indianapolis right now. And this could be, this is like the complete opposite of what they have going on in Indianapolis. And so for the future stability of the franchise, it's a good thing. In fact, I was reading an article this week in preparation for the Ravens game, and one of the most stable, most successful franchises in the National Football League in the last, 15 years has been the Ravens. And the reason that they have been so good is that they've had so few of head coaches, and they've had consistency from ownership to team president to general manager to head coach. Now, they've had a few coaching changes, but for the most part, they have been all on the same page and function incredibly well together. If you don't have that, you have no chance. None. None whatsoever.
I would imagine there's some Jag fans out there that are listening going, wait a minute, what is this 4-year, 5-year plan? We were never led to believe it was going to be half a decade before they could turn this thing around. Mm-hmm. And do you think Gus Bradley regrets the comment, it's built, right? At the beginning of the season, prior to this season, saying the pieces are here, it's built, now it's time to win.
Well, I think he said that with, and look, you probably have to ask him.
Obviously,
exactly what
right,
he meant
I'm just
by
asking
that.
Your
but I mean, my impressions of that comment is that, look, we're built to be competitive week in and week out, which I think at that time, I'm trying to remember which game he said that afterwards. It was the the New England game?
No, I thought that wasn't that a preseason.
It was
comment?
Preseason.
Yeah, it was
yeah.
a preseason.
Yeah,
comment.
But he went back to that again at some point in the regular season.
It
was after disappointing all.
Yeah,
it was after a disappointing loss, and it was a game that they weren't competitive. And I think what he meant by that is that we're built to the point to where we can compete week in and week out. And I think you say that for two reasons. One, you say it so that you're letting everybody know, look, I expect more out of our football team where we're at, but I think it's more important that you say that to let the team know, look, what we just saw and what we're having is not good enough because we didn't compete. We weren't in that game. Now, to say that we're built to play like they have in the last two games, absolutely. To compete, to have a chance to win it in each and every game. And I think we're starting to see that evolve. And I think it was important for him to say that, not so much from a standpoint of letting the fans hear that, but I think it was from the standpoint of letting the players hear that, because in the first 2 years, patience, patience, patience. You know, we're building this thing. We're building it for the long haul. But now you got to let your team know, look, what we're seeing right now is not good enough. And we expect more out of you. We expect more out of us as a coaching staff. And what we have as a result is not good enough. So I think it was right for him to say that.
All right. We got Gus Bradley coming up, and we're going to get your opinion as well on the play of Julius Thomas. A lot of people have been asking about that on the text line this morning. It's something we'd planned on addressing, and we will get to that coming up as well. But we have This State in Football next, the Honda Drive around the NFL. Jeff Loggeman, Fat Tony, Mike Dempsey here with you on a Tuesday, brought to you by Kenny Lay & Associates, DivorceMenOnly.com. It's Jaguars Today, live from Everbank on 1010XL, 92.5 FM.
Now, Jaguars Today on 1010XL, 92.5 FM. And now, This Date in Football History.
All right, This Date in Football History brought to you this week by Dr. James McCall's Comprehensive and Cosmetic Dentistry. On this date, November 10th, 1985, San Diego Charger running back Lionel James. Remember his nickname, Jeffrey? What do you got? Lionel James.
I don't remember his name.
Little Train.
White
Owl. He was 5'6". He gained 345 all-purpose yards, the second highest total in NFL history as the Chargers defeated the L.A. Raiders 40-34 in overtime, and James scored the winning touchdown on a 17-yard run. I don't know if it was the second highest total at that point. Right now, Glenn Milburn holds the record of, I think it's like 404, 405 yards.
What number did Little Train wear?
Oh, boy.
Was it 25?
Might have been. I'd be guessing at this point in time. I'm not a big uniform numbers guy, but I'll go back and look that up for you. 1968, happy 47th birthday to former Jaguar Lonnie Marks. What are your thoughts on Lonnie Marks' two-year run here as a Jag?
First and foremost, you always got everything that he could give, and he's a great guy, and he's also a member of our community and a strong member of our community.
Happy birthday, Lonnie, if you're listening. 1972, this is the guy to me that ultimately keeps Jimmy Smith out of the Hall of Fame, if it ever gets to this point, until he gets in. Isaac Bruce, if in fact he gets into the Hall of Fame, I don't think the door will open up for Jimmy. As good as Jimmy was, what Jimmy has on him is 5 Pro Bowls to 4. Isaac Bruce has most other statistical categories, including receptions over 1,000 to Jimmy's 862, over 15,000 yards to Jimmy's over 12,000, and a better average per catch at 14.9 compared to 14.3. Scored 91 touchdowns to Jimmy's 6. Jimmy was phenomenal. Isaac Bruce is probably criminally underrated, and he's got a Super Bowl ring, which helps with the committee as well.
And he was on a team that had a nickname.
This is true. Greatest show on turf. 1992, happy 23rd to Teddy Bridgewater, born on November 10th as well. This date in football history brought to you by Dr. James McCall's Comprehensive and Cosmetic Dentistry, located on Gate Parkway. If you need cosmetic work done, or maybe you're just in the market for a family dentist, call Dr. McCall's office at 620-9225 or visit jamesjmccall.com to get a complete list of comprehensive care services. That is this date in football history.
Now the Honda Drive Around the NFL, brought to you by your First Coast Honda dealers.
Lionel James was 25, by the way. I did look it up. He wore 26 his last year.
Okay,
because
I do on Wikipedia, I saw 26. I was just about to jump in on that.
It was his last year in 88. It's the only season he wore 26. Denver Broncos cornerback Aqib Talib has been suspended for one game after poking Indianapolis Colts tight end Dwayne Allen in the eye in what he said was an accident on Sunday. Apparently, the NFL, like the rest of the world, wasn't buying Talib's explanation. New England Patriots running back Deion Lewis reportedly tore his left ACL in the Patriots win on Sunday in Washington. He will miss the rest of the year. Lewis caught a screen pass and after going to the ground on the play, immediately grabbed for that left knee. And Rex Ryan continues to use his game day captains to troll opponents. In London, he made the entire Bills offensive line as captains, obviously as a jab towards former head coach Doug Marrone, who now coaches the offensive line here in Jacksonville. Last week against Miami, Richie Incognito was among the team's captains. This week, IKN Impali will be a team captain when the Bills play the Jets. And Impali, the player that punched Geno Smith in the face during the preseason, was subsequently cut by the team and quickly picked up by the Bills. He also showed up to today's Tuesday press conference wearing a Clemson helmet. His son happens to go to Clemson, and they are expected to be number one again tonight when the college football committee's rankings come out.
I'm cool with that. But all that other garbage by Rex Ryan is one of the reasons why he would never be a head coach of mine. I mean, it's childish.
The IK thing seems a step over the line.
The Richie Incognito thing. Just let it die.
Right.
I mean, I understand that Richie is, he's got a second chance. He's playing well for him. But why bring that up again and more to the forefront of the conversation when you're getting ready to play the Miami Dolphins? Why, what does Annapoli have done for the football team to deserve being named a captain? And why would you name the offensive line the captains for the game against, you know, the former head coach who's now the offensive line and coach of the Jets? It's just childish.
That's Rex in many ways.
It's childish, and that's probably the biggest problem that Rex Ryan has. He can't help himself, and he creates distractions with what he does and what he says.
Honestly, when I first read the story, I misread like the first couple lines on this yesterday, and I thought that it said the Jets were making him an honorary captain. I'm thinking, this is the guy that basically opened the door for Ryan Fitzpatrick to make them a playoff contender this year. So if anybody should be making him a captain this year, it probably is not the Buffalo Bills. I don't think he's done much of impact on the football field.
He sold a lot of tickets in Buffalo, that's for sure.
I'm talking about IK.
He's had
Rex.
No impact.
Oh, Rex has sold a ton of tickets.
And then going back to Aqib Talib, one game, I mean, one game. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could have permanently damaged a guy's eye for no reason.
Jeffy was trying to poke him in the helmet.
And for him to say it was unintentional is a joke.
Of course.
I think it should have been 3 games minimum.
Yeah, I wouldn't have had a problem with that. Yeah. I mean, I'm not a fan of dirty play. I don't think it's necessary, you know?
Well, if you punch a guy or you throw a forearm, you know, at the bottom of a pile, that's one thing.
And if it's in the heat of the moment, this was a guy running up. It wasn't even his battle. And he goes up and just tries to gouge the eye.
Three games, what it should have been.
Even Dwayne Allen said it after the game. He's like, it's the first time I've been poked in the eye when I wasn't in the bottom of a pile.
Right.
Like, he expects that kind of stuff if you're going to dive in there after a loose ball.
Everybody apparently expects that under the pile.
But standing up having a discussion with somebody else on the field for somebody to just come up and shove 2 fingers in your eye, I mean...
Not cool.
Come on.
Not cool.
All right, let's get a couple calls in. Next segment we're going to spend listening to Gus Bradley and his comments from yesterday's press conference. But let's go to Pat in Crescent Beach has a question about special teams. Next up here on Jaguars Today. Hi, Pat.
I just wanted to talk about special teams. Let's get Jeff's input. Every time our special teams come out on the field, I cringe. I mean, we have players that didn't even know you couldn't run out of bounds when you're going to cover a punt. We've got our play sticker is learning the game. Every time, and now we put Marshall back there at a critical time. And it just seems like every time our special teams come out there, something bad happens. You're not going to win the game on special teams, but you can sure lose it in the NFL. And it seems like we do. What's your take on that?
Well, it needs to be a lot better. I thought Jason Myers had a very nice game with the field goals. His kickoffs were not great, but at least we had consistency on the field goals. Punt coverage continues to be a problem. They averaged about 10 yards of punt return. One of them was the punter's fault. The other one, it continues to be a coverage issue where you're not getting an impact from the gunners and you're not getting an impact from the personal protector.
How do you fix that?
Well, I think, first of all, if the ones that you have that are doing it are not doing it good enough, you replace them and you put somebody else in there. Right now they got Denard Robinson as the personal protector. And his angles aren't good. He's not attacking. The gunners are not having an impact. You'd like to change them out to somebody else, but the question is, who's next? Who can do it? I mean, I don't know if there's anybody out there that you would feel good about that has the ability to do it a lot better. And I also think when on their punt protection units, they're very slow to release as the ball is being kicked. A lot of times in a perfect world, what you'd like to have is that, okay, you block to protect the punter, and then you're releasing before the ball is punted so that you're crossing at or near the line of scrimmage in full stride running. And right now, it's almost as if they're worried about protection too much and not about coverage. That's why you're seeing such great separation between when the punt returner of the opponent catches the ball. If you pause the film or pause your TV, take a look at the distance on a great hang time punt.
Mm-hmm.
It's huge. And it's because they're not getting off of the blocks or attacking the guys that are rushing the punt and then getting through the line of scrimmage in a timely fashion.
How much effect have the roster decisions they've had to make with whatever it was, Marquise Lee, and whether he could go that weekend or not? Especially, I mentioned this to you earlier on a break, but Leroy Reynolds, having to let him go, how much has that affected what they do on special teams?
It affects a lot because Leroy Reynolds was what I call a coverage demon. I mean, he was very effective in that role. Sometimes he made some bad decisions as a blocker on those return units, but you know, you got to have some demons, but you also have to give them the ability to be demons. I think the way that they coach it needs to be changed a little bit. And you know, and I've always believed this. You know, I don't care where your roster is at. I believe this to my heart. Special teams is will and want to. And even if your roster is back to where it was back in 2 years ago, that you still have the ability to be good if it's emphasized and if you have the right mindset. Because the difference in talent on special teams, can it be great? Yes. But can the results be greatly different? No. I think it's a mindset. And that mindset needs to be improved.
All right. Thank you for the call, Pat. Let's go to Ryan in Mandarin before we break here. Hi, Ryan. How are you?
Yeah, doing well. This is for Lagerman. You know, I'm just curious, you know, how do you feel about coaching? I mean, I know we have a bunch of different types of coaches out there, from the McElwains to the Coughlins to the, you know, McSabins, the Del Rios, the Steve Spurriers. Do you feel that there's a big difference in whether the coaches pat the guy on the butt, beat him down, kind of intermediate, or ignore them? Do you feel the coaching is that big of a difference in these athletes? And I'll take your call off the air. I'm just kind of curious how you feel about, you know, their attitudes.
Sure. I think, first of all, there's a lot of different styles in coaching, and there's no one style that works. I think there's different styles that have been greatly effective. You know, Bill Walsh, Marv Levy were the complete opposite of a Bill Parcells and a Bill Belichick. Bill Belichick and Parcells can be somewhat demeaning, hard, boisterous, abrasive, whereas Bill Walsh was matter-of-fact, talked to you intelligently. And so I think all kinds work. But the one thing that is very clear, great coaches are great coaches. Nick Saban, I think, is a perfect example of that. I don't care where Nick Saban goes. That guy's a great football coach. If Nick Saban went to Bowling Green, I bet you that Bowling Green could compete for whatever title that Bowling Green ever competes for. I mean, there are some guys that just can flat-out coach. Tom Coughlin can flat-out coach. I think the NFL is a little different in some respects than college football, because you don't have the ability to supply the groceries, to use the old line that Bill Parcells mm-hmm. used to use when he was on his way out of the door in New England. You know, so you can get better players, and it's a little bit, I don't want to say it's easier, because you still have to recruit extremely hard, but it's different from the college game to the NFL game. But great coaching is great coaching.
All right, let's take a time out here. We'll come back and hear from the coach of your Jacksonville Jaguars, Gus Bradley, his Monday press conference, and reflect on some of his thoughts here. Mike Dempsey, Jeff Lagerman, Fat Tony here with you on a Tuesday, brought to you by Kenny Lane Associates, DivorceMenOnly.com. Jaguars Today continues in a moment, live from Everbank on 1010XL, 92.5 FM.
Now more with Jeff Lagerman, brought to you by Roland Reich Plumbing on Jaguars Today, 1010XL, 92.5 FM.
All right, let's get to the head coach of your Jacksonville Jaguars, Gus Bradley, meets with the media every Monday after some time to reflect and watch a little bit of film and see how his team performed on Sunday. Here's what he had to say opening up his comments yesterday.
You know, we met today, and like always, we tell the truth. And, you know, we went through everything, but I was very pleased with our team's effort overall. I think our preparation going in the game, the clarity that we talk about with our team, I thought was very evident going to a tough environment. It's a very good team that we face. And to go up there and at least the mindset that we had going into the game, I was very pleased. Saw some good things offensively, 430 yards of total offense, 13 explosive plays. I think it's the most that we've had this year. Defensively, limited rushing attack to 29 yards. You know, all really good signs. 1.1 yards per carry. Special teams, you know, saw some good things as far as our return units, some flashes of it. So, you know, I think that was all good. I love the spirit of our team. I love how they're relentless and they don't blink and they battle and they fight and they scratch and they'll do everything it can to give us a chance to be victorious. Unfortunately, that's not enough. I think at critical times in the game, you know, offensively we got to make plays, defensively you got to make stops, and special teams you got to come through. And that's what we're not doing right now. And so, you know, we'll continue to look at it, evaluate the tape. They're doing it with the players right now, and we'll continue to grow.
Is Gus getting frustrated a little bit there? I mean, it's that, you know, he's usually 97% positive. He'll point out some areas of deficiency, but it seems like to me he's a little more pointed publicly. And, again, I'm saying this publicly. The way he deals with his team behind closed doors, we assume he's certainly more pointed on the areas they need improvement on. But do you sense that he's like, hey, whether he's not necessarily, I don't want to use the wrong phrasing, calling guys out on the carpet or whatever, but enough is enough, guys, because we are good enough to win these games. We should have won that game, and let's not accept that we're just having good effort and here are some great things, because we're ultimately killing ourselves with some of these mistakes that we're making.
Yeah, I think that, you know, he talks to his team probably the same words that he uses in a press conference, but probably in a different tone. And I think that when you do it in a press conference, you know, you're trying to be measured and not give the impression that you're trying to be negative towards, you know, any one player or the team overall. But I think when you get in front of the team in a different setting, you know, I think it's probably different. And, yeah, I'm sure he's frustrated, and he should be frustrated. You know, the expectation of your team is more. And I'm not talking about the win. I'm talking about just the performance in the game. I mean, you don't expect, you know, to have punt return to still be an issue in covering. You don't expect that Telvin Smith jumps into the neutral zone on a 3rd and 7 to give, you know, the team an opportunity at 3rd and 2 and then a 4th and 2 when they've got a kicker issue. You don't expect to have completions on 3rd and 12 happen at a higher rate against you than any other team in the National Football League. I mean, those things have to change. And so as long as you're making sure that the message that you send when you have your press conference is the same, but maybe in a little different fashion, the way it's spoken in front of the team, that's, I think, as a player, that's what you want. You don't want to have a coach who comes out in a press conference like Jay Gruden, to use an example. I think that Jay, the way Jay handles himself in press conferences, I think is not good for his team and the psyche of a team. You know, because you got to be consistent. I think players always kind of play the, how many times have you heard players talk about the respect thing? Mm-hmm. You hear it all the time, right? And I think when players see that there's consistency from the coach after wins, after losses, in front of the media, in front of the team, I think that's what they appreciate most. And I think it's easier to coach that way because you're not trying to cover your bases because maybe you spoke differently in one place as opposed to another.
Look at Lovie Smith made some comments, was asked about this. This is reported in the Tampa Bay Times, talking about Lavonte David and Gerald McCoy, right? Mm-hmm. Two of the guys that have been stalwarts for that team for a number of years now. He said, Lavonte's a great player. Same thing with Gerald. I think you have to be careful when you just look at the stat sheet. But forgetting about the stat sheet, our play from both of these guys, we would say it's not good enough. Okay, and now he may tell them to their face that mm-hmm. as well. I think there's a segment of the Jaguar fan base that would like to hear more pointed criticism. Do you think that's fair or unfair, or do you think that's just something that may make you feel good in the short term and it doesn't really have any bottom line effect on your football team?
I think in that case, I think, not really Lovie's case, but in the case of like calling players out, I think it would make the coach feel better, and I think it would make the fan base feel better. But is it really making it better for the players or for the team?
Does some guys respond differently, though? Could some guys, you know, I know players like to say, we don't pay attention to what's being said. I don't believe that. Mm-hmm. I think they're aware. Whether they're dwelling on it day to day is another story. Could some guys sometimes use, I'm not saying anybody in particular, I don't have anybody in mind here, but could some people use some of that, hey, let's put it out there.
Absolutely.
This guy needs that.
Absolutely. And Lovie's the kind of coach in that situation that Lovie, I'm sure, said the same thing to Gerald McCoy and Lavonte David, because Lovie's consistent like that. You know, could something like that work? Absolutely, because different things motivate players in different ways. You know, some player, if you pat him on the butt, that might be the greatest motivation that he needs, whereas as opposed to another player, maybe the sense of embarrassment for him getting called out or to be mentioned in a conference for not performing to a standard that is expected out of them, maybe that's what drives that player.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've always stuck in my mind, Terry Bradshaw said something about that once, that he was the kind of guy that no matter what he did to screw up, pat him on the back and he'll go kill for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you get all over his case, he would not have responded well.
Right.
These are two guys that have been Pro Bowl players. They probably realize themselves that they're not playing up to their past standards. And I think it's easier when you've had a guy that's had a number of years of success to point out, hey, I'll use them as an example. They're going to get it. And the rest of the team knows that nobody's above reproach.
Well, and I'm sure that Lovie knows that Gerald McCoy and Lavonte David can handle
it. That's what I'm saying.
And that also is that you're talking about the two of the defensive leaders on the football team. So by calling them out, you know that they can handle it. You know that then they start saying, hey, look, I have to set a better standard for myself. I have to perform at a higher level. And I think when you have a player that, like, in those situations where they're expected to be leaders and they're not performing at a level that's expected of them, I think that that's okay to do that. Not necessarily in a press conference, but certainly in private.
I'm not sure that he's expected to be a leader, but didn't Gus do that with Devon House? And how has he responded in the last couple of weeks? He was put back into the starting lineup this week. How did he respond?
I thought he responded very well. But you know, I think Gus never had a malicious, you know, slant to any of his comments about Devon House. You know, I think that's
I don't think Gus is wired that way. I mean, what was the comment?
No, he's not wired that way.
He said, you know, this is.
It was.
He said, what was it?
It was in the It was preseason. He said he needs. We expect more. He needs to get better. I can't remember.
It was.
Exactly
it was even
it was.
Less. Yeah. Less pointed than that. And he's like, you know, when I say that.
Yeah.
That means he's probably not doing so great.
I thought that he did well recently when he took him out of the lineup in the London game. He said that, well, Devon, you know, typically is not used to playing an entire game. You know, he's been playing 25 snaps and sub in Green Bay. So it's kind of an interesting way of saying, well, you know, maybe he can't handle it.
And right. Go show me that you can.
So if I'm Devon House, I'm like, wait a minute. I can handle that. I'm going to prove it to you that I can handle it. So maybe it was just a little subtle way,
right, sure.
You know, of motivating Devon House.
And maybe that's how Devon House needs to be motivated.
Maybe.
And Gus has that kind of idea. Gus Bradley yesterday also talked about specifically one of the big back-breaking plays for the Jaguars, that fumble by Blake Bortles.
I think sometimes what happens in the red zone, when you look at some of the things that we talk about, depending on the team that we're playing, is that there are opportunities to run in the red zone. And there's a couple opportunities where he could take advantage of that and, you know, just run the ball and get as much as he can or slide, and we'll go on to the next play.
It seems like it's part of the learning process of being a young quarterback, right?
He's
I think Gus is saying there, hey, look, dude, tuck it and go. Just get us 5 yards.
He did it on first down to get him to the 3. There was just a holding call on Parnell.
Yeah, and I think that penalty maybe interrupted the mindset of Blake saying, wait a minute, we were first and goal at the 10, now we're first and goal at the 20. I got to make something happen.
Right.
Wait a minute, slow down. You know, don't make something happen, kind of let it come to you and take the plays that are going to be given to you and in that instance run it or just throw it away.
All right, here's one that I think a lot of people have been waiting to hear from you on, Jeff. So let's hear first from Gus Bradley talking about Julius Thomas and ask specifically if conditioning with Julius is where Gus wants it to be.
I think he's still working on it, but, you know, Julius, is unfortunate because there's a couple plays there that we had set up for him for big plays. And one, maybe the timing, the fade route that was in the end zone. There's another play that we had set up for him that because of protection, it broke down. We underthrew him a little bit. Blake got hit, I think, right prior. So he was second most targeted guy on the team, you know, as far as receivers. So that timing, that, you know, I don't know how much of it is conditioning, be a great question for him. But I think the timing, the more and more they work together, I think the better it'll be.
I really expected, and I said this before the game, if there was ever a guy that really needed to raise his level of play in this game, that specific game, the Jets game, it was Julius Thomas, because they are a very good defense. They're good against the run. You knew you were going to be in some 3rd and 6-plus situations, and having an effective Julius Thomas working the field with man coverage, with the safety being out of the lineup and Calvin Pryor, it was a perfect setup. The one throw that Blake had to him, off balance, had two guys in his face. If Blake is able to have the time and stand up and throw that ball, that's a significant gain. Julius had a drop early in the ball game. Another pressure that Blake had. He was looking Julius's way, and Julius's head wasn't even turned around. I don't know if that's on Julius or if that's just the route that's expected of him. You know, but I thought that Greg Olsen could have done things maybe a little different in some respect, in that when the Jets did start to have that package to where they had a lot of these linebackers standing up and TJ was having some issues with protection, is to have Julius involved in a little shorter route combination. I think that's what's made Jason Witten just an incredibly great player for the Dallas Cowboys for so long, because he's a move the chains tight end. And I think that this team needs to get to the point where Julius becomes that for them and more, because we know he's capable of more. I expect, because we saw it in the preseason, that he was the most dominant player in training camp, along with Allen Robinson. So we know that what's happening with Allen Robinson now, and we had a little bit of a, I guess you could say Julie's had a little bit of a delay because of the hand injury. I expect him in these last 8 weeks to be a significantly bigger part of this offense, and he needs to be for this team to start getting better at moving the chains. They were like 44% on third downs against the New York Jets. That's a strong number. But, I mean, overall for the season, they're hovering right around 35, 36%, which is not good enough if you're going to expect to win a lot of games. Julius Thomas has to be directly responsible for getting that number to be higher and to take some pressure off of Blake, filling the pressure that I have to push the ball down the field. Because if Blake feels like I've got a guy that I can throw it to when it's third and five and be content with moving the chains right here, then we can line up and play another set of downs. Then I can find a bigger play somewhere else. That has to be the biggest improvement in the Jaguars offense in the remaining eight games because it's expected out of them. They didn't pay him all that money, and I'm not faulting him. I'm just saying they didn't pay him all that money with the expectation that he would be just a okay player because you know he's capable of more than that. We saw it in preseason, and I expect to see it in the last eight games.
So just quickly, one more on the conditioning thing. I think Gus leaves open the possibility that he isn't in, you know, the best condition for whatever combination of reasons, simply when he says, I don't know, possibly, you know, that's something you'd probably be better off asking him, right? I think that leaves it open. There is a picture of him in the locker room after the game in London. He looked like he had a gut, right? I mean, that's just the pictures can be deceiving sometimes. We understand that.
Well, he's never been an Adonis.
Understood, right? Yeah. But so you're just looking at Julius Thomas, though, and some guys are like that. Some guys play a little bit heavier. Are you okay with the kind of, just from what you can tell, the kind of shape he's in right now?
I don't know. You know, I don't know what his wind is. I just know that I think he can be more sudden in some of his routes. Is that condition? Maybe. Can it be a little bit more awareness on his part? Could it be that the injury that he had in London that kept him out at the end of that ball game, is that slowing him down right a little bit? I don't know. All I know is that if the result or the expectation of what you're expecting to see is not there, something needs to change to get it to be there. So for me, I don't care how, what, or why, just show it to me.
Sure. And one more cut from Gus Bradley. He was asked a pretty pointed question about the return game for this Jaguars team. Specifically, does he trust Brian Walters more than Nick Marshall in the return game?
We haven't had an issue really with Nick that I can think of. You know, I think with Nick's situation, you know, one of the things we're looking at is we're looking for returns. You know, we're trying to get more yards of return. A kickoff return, he had a couple really good returns. And then the punt return, the 20-yarder. And, you know, going into that situation where it was on the field, felt like he gave us the best opportunity. I think when he looked, he saw a lot of green grass down the sideline. And, took his eye off of it for a split second. He can't do that.
Well, I just, you know, I don't have a problem with Nick Marshall being back there at that point. I think it's a good question. Do you trust Brian Walters more? I think, yeah, you trust Brian Walters more. Not so much from catching the ball, but you trust Brian Walters more to make good judgments when you're down around that 10-yard line and field awareness, because that's something in the preseason that we saw that Nick Marshall didn't have a great awareness of.
And I do think that is a factor when you talk, because people were debating this inside the 10, outside the 10, why would you have two different guys? A lot of teams use different
sure
punt returners in situational
absolutely
circumstances. I'm surprised that people are so surprised that the Jags have two guys you would use. And I do think that decision, when you're standing with your feet on the 10 or the 8-yard line, and do I catch this, do I not catch this, I think that's where you trust Brian Walters more.
Sure.
At this point in time, just due
nothing
to
wrong with that,
more
that and that's not out of the ordinary, you know. And
bottom line, Nick Marshall just catch the ball and,
yeah,
and
just
go,
catch
go
the ball and roll,
20,
baby.
30-yard return, yeah. And then everything's fine.
Got a 20-yarder in the game, you know. I mean, it would have been great. I mean, if he catches that ball and doesn't do anything special, he gains probably 15 yards.
All right, Loggy, I know you got to jet out of here a little bit early today, so we're going to say goodbye to you. But what do you have coming up the rest of the week?
Gus Bradley radio show Thursday night, Jaguars Thursday after that. So those are 6 to 8 o'clock at night. Gus Bradley TV show Saturday night and Sunday morning. Pregame television show Sunday morning at 11:30.
Film room Friday
coming up. We're actually looking ahead. Going to be looking at a little bit of Joe Flacco. And outdoor show Saturday morning. And game broadcast with Frank and Big Bo.
There you go. That's a full plate right there. By the way, a quick bit of news coming from the Ravens. Oh, man. The preseason legend, Cap Cappy, has been let go, so he will not get a chance to enact his revenge and seek it against the Jaguars this weekend. So
I let me just say this. I watched the Ravens yesterday. Darryl Smith should still be a Jaguar.
Darryl Smith is been,
he's timeless.
He's been phenomenal since they signed him.
I'm telling you, Mike, he might be their best defensive player.
This year, I would not doubt that at all. Because trust me, you know, even in fantasy, Tony and I play with defensive players. And
yep.
I'm well aware of what Darryl Smith has done for the last several years.
He's playing at a higher level than C.J. Mosley.
I mean, he's getting sacks. He's great in coverage. He's a tackle machine.
That was the one guy that when Dave Caldwell and Gus Bradley came in here and he was part of that, you know, cleaning the house. I was like, thing is, Jeff,
he sat out there for months.
Could have got him back for nothing.
Yeah. For a better minimum, man. And then, you know, the Ravens have rewarded him with a new 4-year deal and he's living up to it.
He's worth every penny.
All right, buddy. We'll see you. Thank you, Jeff. Jeff Logman on Twitter at logs56, logs56. And of course, in here every Tuesday with us on Jaguars Today. We'll come back. Tony, I'll take a look at the fan feedback spotlight. Then we'll tell you who Jeff's nominee was for an answer for that coming up as well, asking you which Jaguar player benefited from the rest the most based on their performance against the New York Jets this past Sunday. It is a Tuesday brought to you by Kenny Lane Associates, DivorceMenOnly.com. More Jaguars Today to come on 1010XL 92.5 FM. All right, down the stretch we come. Mike Dempsey, Fat Tony. Got Fat Tuesday tonight, right?
Yeah.
Time, please.
9 to 10 tonight here on 1010XL, 92.5 FM. Obviously, the college football playoff rankings will be out by the time I hit the air, so have a chance to react to that, as well as a lot of other stuff going on around this team here in Jacksonville with the Jaguars as they get ready now to take on Baltimore. And some of the stuff we talked about yesterday, I think the reflections of what kind of win total does this team need coming down the stretch. And you compare that with the comments of Dave Caldwell, they've won 2 out of 7 games that they've been competitive in. What kind of number do they need here over the last half of the season for everybody to feel safe here in Jacksonville with the job they're doing?
Well, we know 0 is not good enough, right?
We know that, and
we had that discussion a little bit earlier, Tony, with Jeff Logman, that, you know, if they go 6-10, meaning they go 4-4 in their last 8, and they're competitive in their other games, and I guess some of it depends on maybe who you beat as well, but let's say they do, I find it hard to believe that a 6-10 record is going to get Gus Bradley fired.
I do too.
With the sentiment expressed in London by Shad Khan and by the support that Dave Caldwell has shown him. So what is the I don't know what
right.
that number is if, in between.
If there is in the last 8 games of this season, as they have been 7 of the 8 in the first half of this season, and they only win 2 of them, again, like they have in this
right.
first
if
half.
Right, if a duplicate second half.
Right, is that in Dave Caldwell and Shad Khan's mind winning your fair share of close games with the opportunities they've been given? It's a tough question to answer.
I don't think. For me, I mean, it's a good enough percentage, but I don't know. You know, I'm not the one making the decision, but, you know, bottom line it, 4-3-4. If they were to go 2-6, that would be the win totals for the last 3 years. And, you know, well, I think we can all acknowledge there is progress in terms of the talent level and the competitive level of this team compared to, you go back to the first 8 games of 2013. I mean, you're getting blown out historically every single week. But ultimately, the results are the same. The numbers of wins are the same. So
no, they are. And know. Also tonight, going to get a little bit into Veterans Day is tomorrow.
Yes.
And want to take a look back. I know today is the birthday, I think the 242nd birthday of the United States Marine Corps is today. So we'll talk about that a little bit tonight.
Semper Fi, all you Marines out there. Is it inappropriate for someone who's a non-Marine to say Semper Fi? I don't know.
I have no idea.
I mean it respectfully to all those
I know you
folks
do.
Out there. Maybe tomorrow, Tony, if we're allowed to do it. I don't. I've got my own personal pair of ducats to Thursday Night Football. This is not a sponsorship deal.
Sweet.
My wife's not going because, you know, the kid's got school the next morning. Maybe we find a way to get him in the hands of a veteran. Tomorrow.
That'd be cool.
That wouldn't be too shabby. Today, Fan Feedback Spotlight asks you to tell us which player you think benefited the most from having the week off. Who appeared to have the fresh legs? Whose performance took a step forward after the bye week? What do we get?
Here's what we got from Duval Doom, low key. Looks like it might have been Jonathan Cyprian from Jason Gus. He didn't say the same things we heard last week from Stoff, the law firm of Allen & Allen, founded by McCardo and Smith. I retweeted that pic. It's pretty cool if you want to go check out my timeline. From Paolo, definitely the D-line being able to stuff the run. From Daniel, I think Marks, every week he gets stronger and stays healthy, helps. From Desert Gold, we got Myers Sip in that run defense, hashtag my sorry. From Adam, apparently Jason Myers, maybe just bringing in kickers fired him up. He didn't miss a kick. Yes, that Jason Myers. And from Irish Jaguar, Myers looked much better on the field goals. His kickoffs still need work.
We didn't get into this with Jeff. He had to go, but Andy Zeller hit Jeff's pick on Facebook. He said, I think Sendarek Marks is starting to come back, and I see him really making progress to get back to his former self. Jeff said it was very noticeable watching on tape how much better Marks was after a week of rest and you know, getting his legs under him a little bit there.
He looked like the old Sendarek in the first quarter. I know that, and their run defense was fierce on Sunday. And the pass rush was a little bit better than it's been. It wasn't great, but it was a little bit better than it's been against the Jets this week. So they didn't have to blitz as much to get pressure this week, and I think that's a positive sign for this team going forward. And I think it is an indication of a guy like Sendarek Marks coming back, because he's the biggest X factor for them improving that pass rush in 2015. It's wherever Marks goes, because that's the guy who drove it last year for him too.
Yeah, I would argue Dante Fowler Jr. may be the biggest impact.
Not in 2016. Oh, I'm talking about in 2015.
Oh, in 2015. I'm sorry. I thought you were talking about going ahead to next year.
No.
I misheard you there for a second. Look, you're playing against the Baltimore team this week. Fat, who are the playmakers on this football team? Let's be serious. I mean, look, Justin Forsett's a nice running back at this stage of his career. He's having an okay season. Kamar Aiken is the guy in the passing game right now. Crockett Gilmore is just as average as the day is long. Mm-hmm. You cannot let this team get off on you offensively, the Baltimore Ravens. Now, you know, defensively, they've hung around in some games, but they've also given up a lot in the passing game this year.
Their season is... them in San Diego, it's remarkably similar to what's going on in Jacksonville. Honestly, it's a bunch of games where it comes down to the fourth quarter and they found a way to lose most of those football games. And it's been the same thing with Baltimore and San Diego. San Diego did it again last night. I don't think that's a particularly bad football team. Their record is terrible.
San Diego's issue, though, I think, stems from a devastating wave of injuries.
No, they got a ton of injuries, but they've been in every game in the fourth quarter.
Understood.
Baltimore has been in every game in the fourth quarter, and they found a way to lose. It's like Jacksonville, where they've been in these football games, they lose.
I almost feel though like San Diego's almost overachieved to be in all these games in the fourth quarter, whereas Baltimore may have underachieved to be at that same position. I know they've lost Steve Smith. They just lost Steve Smith. It's not just Keenan Allen that San Diego's been without. At one point, they were without 80% of their offensive line.
Yeah.
And, you know, last night you had no Denzel Perryman, no Manti Te'o. They played the last 3 weeks without Eric Weddle in there. Now Jason Verrett, who this guy, maybe a top five corner in the league now. You look at him.
He was shutting down.
He was all over Alshon Jeffrey until he pulls his groin on the first ball that they hit to Jeffrey. He had the pick six already, and he goes out of the game, and Jeffrey goes absolutely cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs yesterday. So, good ball player.
From a fantasy perspective, I was not sad to see that.
Nor was
when Verrett left the game, I was like, oh, finally.
Thank you. Yes, yes. I am in total lockstep with you on that one. All right, that does it for us today. Thanks to Kenny Lane Associates, DivorceMenOnly.com. They are our Tuesday sponsor here of Jaguars Today. Coming up tomorrow, more of the same. Getting you ready, though, for Baltimore as we look ahead to the second half of the season kicking off. Thanks to Jeff Loggeman for weighing in today, as he does every Tuesday. Thanks to all of you out there for listening and participating in the program. That does it for us. For Fat Tony, for Tyler Devitt, and for Joe Fortunato, as well as Jeff Loggeman, I'm Mike Dempsey. XL Primetime coming up next right here on 1010XL 92.5 FM.
Now, Duval, give me two claps and a Ric Flair.
Woo!
That's great job!